By the way, not always in the meeting, in the moment, does the senior leader act like they appreciate it. It's yeah. usually only later that they realize that you prevented us from making a disastrous mistake, and now I value it and I appreciate it. You have to be okay, nonetheless, with not getting the immediate love and positive feedback from that leader in the moment, because they may be more focused on how do I get this done quickly, not whether it's the right thing to get done in the first place. That's our job, is to help, you know, minimize the risk of those kinds of big and bad decisions being made.
Absolutely. This is the Rebel HR Podcast, the podcast where we talk to HR innovators about all things people leadership. If you're looking for places to find about new ways to think about the world of work, this is the podcast for you. Please subscribe from your favorite podcast listening platform today and leave us a review. Rebel on, HR Rebels. All right, Rebel HR listeners, welcome back to the show. Really excited for our guest this week. He has survived over 40 years in human resources. So listen up here. We've got an expert in our midst. He is the president of Exec Excel Group, LLC, and he has a significant amount of experience. His name is Ian Ziskin. He has been a human resources leader, board advisor and member, coach, consultant, entrepreneur, teacher, speaker, and author. He is here to talk to us today about the book, The Secret Sauce for Leading Transformational Change. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Great to be with you, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Well, excited to be here. And I think this is just going to be a ton of fun. So I want to start off by just asking kind of the proverbial question I ask anybody that spends a significant amount of their time writing books. What prompted you to write a book about leading transformational change?
In this case, actually two things combined, both over the course of the last couple of years. First, as most people I think can relate to, sitting around my house during the height of COVID, watching what was going on around me, not only in the health-related challenges that people were dealing with, which of course, terrible, but also the economic uncertainty, the disruption caused by people at work trying to figure out how to get work done remotely, in most cases, almost overnight. Same thing with school, with, you know, teachers and students and parents all trying to figure out how to make school work during that time. And also some of the political division that I think we're experiencing, not only in this country, but around the world. It all made me stop and think about what are the circumstances under which people survive and perhaps even thrive during times of large-scale transformational change? So that was driver number one. Driver number two was the fact that a few years ago, a colleague of mine and I co-founded a consortium of other coaches and consultants. It's called Consortium for Change, and a highly collaborative community network of people. And in examining this question of leading transformational change, we have quite a few people who are interested in and experts in our group around the topic of transformational change. And we wanted to do something with a book that would be highly collaborative, but also very diverse in terms of the lenses that people looked at transformational change through. And both of those things combined caused me to dive into this idea of writing this book.
Absolutely. You know, it's one of those things, you know, that we think about like change management, we think about like cultural change, transformational change, and it's always been a buzzword in the background of any organization I've worked at, right? Like you need to be a change agent, you need to drive cultural change. But for me, it's always been, it's always kind of been really hard to kind of get my arms around what that even meant. You know, I feel like, it's kind of different for everybody. And then I think some people honestly just throw those buzzwords out there so that they sound smart, right? So, okay. So as you were writing this book and kind of thinking through this big question, you know, how did you kind of rally around the scope of what you meant by really transformational change? You know, what are the aspects that you were looking at as it relates to, you know, this type of evolution in an organization?
A couple of different lenses that got us to that place, Kyle. One was recognizing that change or transformational change or whatever someone might choose to call it takes place at a variety of different levels or layers. You know, there's the individual level, there's the team level, there's the organizational level, and there's even the societal level. So we were trying to look at it from those different angles, if you will. The other thing that we started to do was, you know, ask ourselves some questions and establish some maybe hypotheses to begin putting the book together. A couple of the questions were things like, you know, for leaders who are successful at leading transformational change, what do they actually do? You know, the practical aspects of what they actually do to make that happen. Similarly, why do we so often fail to successfully lead transformational change? Because there's always lessons learned from the things that don't work. And one of the hypotheses, just to use as an example, is we began with this concept that all transformation is change, but is all change transformational? Over the course of pulling the book together, came to the conclusion that no, at least in our view, not all change is transformational. And some of the things that make it more transformational is when you're driving a significant amount of change that leads to a substantial improvement in effectiveness, health, happiness, and even survival of someone or something. That's totally different than a short-term tweak or minor adjustment that you might make, which may be very legitimate, may actually really need to be done, but isn't the same as transformational change, at least in our view, as we wrote this book.
So you're telling me that the like quarterly pizza parties is not enough to drive the cultural employee engagement change we need to make?
Not in my view, but you know, I'm glad you mentioned pizza because one of the things we can talk about is this pizza analogy, as I like to call it, of looking at pizza both as a food and as an industry, as a bit of a metaphor for why transformational change actually matters. So we can talk about that, you know, now or later in our conversation. But
yeah, let's go down the pizza rabbit hole. I'm in, Ian.
Yeah. So you know, we kind of asked this question. You know, what does pizza have to do with leading transformational change? It turns out rather a lot. Let's just go back in history more than a little bit. So you know, 997 AD in Gaeta, Italy, is when pizza was first thought to be invented. And ever since that time, you know, many years that have gone by, you know, all of the traditions and tastes associated with pizza. However, if you look at reality and you think about it in terms of shape, sizes, toppings, cheeses, crusts, preparation methodologies, distribution channels, and of course, the many secret sauces that people have for pizza, all of that has been completely transformed many times over. You know, it's all been about the reimagination and reinvention and repositioning of pizza, both as a food and as an industry, in order to remain relevant up against all of these different external and internal trends that pizza has faced that mostly you'd say they don't control. And, you know, I would ask your listeners to think about it in the context of their particular lives, personally and professionally. All of the things that they're facing that are external forces of change and internal forces of change in their own organizations that they don't control. But to what degree have they been hanging on to traditions and things that seem to be comfortable, that fit, you know, kind of like a original definition of pizza, and how does that have to morph over time in order to be more competitive or more successful? And I love a quote I came across as part of researching the book and the pizza industry that goes something like this: if cauliflower can become pizza, you can become anything. And so it's one of those things where you think to yourself, 20 years ago, I never imagined that cauliflower and pizza would be mentioned in the same sentence. And now it's a thing, as they say. I'm a bit of a traditionalist myself, so I'm not sure I'm wild about cauliflower crust pizza. But there are plenty of other people who are, and teaches us valuable lessons about the need to morph and adjust along the way.
Okay, so we made the link between the pizza party and organizational change. So, you know, Ian, I think that's a first of the podcast. If I had a merit badge, I would give you one right now. So nice work.
I'll gratefully accept it, even though you probably had no idea what you were walking into, Kyle.
I didn't.
I'm happy to be at least a participant in this charade.
I didn't, but there is literally a chapter in the book called Pizzanology. So, you know, it was probably subliminal that like I mentioned pizza just so that I could like give you that softball, but I appreciate you hitting it out of the park.
We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
But I think it's, you know, I think it's really funny. You know, it's kind of a funny analogy, but I think it's a really important one, you know, and you know, I tend to be I like change, right? I'm like I'm one of these people that doesn't like sitting still and, you know, quite frankly, that can be a little bit destabilizing for some that I work with. And maybe a little bit atypical for many in the HR, function. So for those that aren't wired like that, that are, you know, maybe a little bit more cautious, with change or, you know, kind of maybe have a little bit of a stigma associated with large scale change. As you were writing this book and working through that, what kinds of common things did you see to help overcome some of that kind of that natural resistance that exists in many of us?
Turns out, maybe to start off with, that I'm a believer when you write a book, hopefully you teach people a few things that they didn't know, but also you should learn something yourself. You know, as the author, or in this case, I'm the lead author of this book with contributions from quite a few other people. And there were a number of ahas for me in writing the book, one of which deals specifically with this question that you just asked, which is that quite often when you're focusing on the topic of change, there's always this debate about whether people actually like change or hate change. And you were, you know, kind enough to share your view that you're more of the I like change kind of person, and that's great. I think I'm more that way myself. But I kept seeing over and over again in all the stories and examples of the book that turns out most people actually do hate change. That's my conclusion. I'm not proud to say that, but I think it's actually true. However, perhaps more importantly, is that the only thing that they hate more than change, quite typically, is failure. And so even people who are concerned about, reluctant about, resistant to change, generally share this common point of view that they hate to fail and do not want to be associated with failure at the individual, team, organizational, or societal levels that we were talking about earlier. That gives you a better than 50% chance of persuading people that change might be necessary. Because even if they don't like it or certainly don't love it, they recognize that they have this motivation not to fail and put themselves and their organization or the team in the best position possible to be successful and win. That was a very common theme throughout all aspects of putting this book together.
Interesting. It's like the least worst option, right? It's like they hate it, but they hate it a little bit less than the alternative, right?
Well, so. the other least worst option that also is very common throughout the book that is maybe a corollary to what we were just talking about is this idea of coming to terms with reality or the truth. One of the other common aspects of learning from this book is that human beings have this miraculous capacity, almost limitless, to deny, deflect data or facts that do not reinforce their preferred view of the internal or external environment. And so what you find happening again, not only with individuals as human beings, but also with organizations, is a lot of time and energy wasted on denying reality as opposed to facing into it and recognizing the inevitability of the need for change, or at least the inevitability of the trends and circumstances that are surrounding them that really can't be changed. So I say with a certain amount of humility that if you can do a better job than you've done in the past as an individual of seeing, understanding, and then eventually accepting the facts, just the circumstance that you're facing, gives you a big leg up. One of the examples I give in the book that I think most people can relate to is people step on a scale and recognize that maybe it's time to lose 10 pounds. The facts are irrefutable. You know, the scale, the numbers are staring back at you and you're recognizing that maybe it's time to lose some weight. Most people also intellectually understand that some combination of diet and exercise is usually the solution to losing weight. But it turns out that facts somehow also need to be reconciled with feelings, because it's the internal motivation, you know, what's in your head, what's in your heart, that's basically going to determine whether you do the dieting and the exercising that are typically required in order to lose the 10 pounds. Some people will, some people won't, but it becomes a matter of motivation, which is much more about feeling and human understanding of those feelings than it is about the irrefutability of the facts, because just getting on the scale and looking at the numbers will not cause you to lose weight. You actually have to do something beyond that to make it happen.
It's funny. I'm sitting here just kind of smiling to myself. You know, it's like, we know how to lose that 10 pounds, right? Like, we have figured that question out, right? Diet and exercise. That's, I mean, you can look at every fad diet and whatever, but at the end of the day, it really comes down to diet and exercise. Everybody knows that. But how many people still just don't do it, right? And I think it's a great analogy for, you know, kind of that change. You know, it's like, I can't tell you how many times, you know, we have some process that just doesn't work. And instead of actually fixing the process, we're just like, well, it just is what it is. That's the way we've always done it. You know, whatever. Here's this workaround. Takes me an extra X amount of time and we'll just kind of work through it. But and many of those things just could become ingrained in somebody. And the feeling that they have about it is, well, it's good enough. It's fine, right? Like, it's just something I'm okay with and I don't have the motivation to change it. But I think as you think about like large scale transformational change, you know, that those are the things that can be really, really challenging. So I'm really curious because, and this is something that, you know, I've kind of seen again and again in my career. It's, you know, it's almost like there's a couple different schools of thought related to transformational change. And I'll kind of stay scoped in on the organizational change, like, you know, the HR person that's trying to drive cultural change or something like that. It's the question of like, is it grassroots change? Is it like small little incremental steps at the, you know, at the kind of at the bottom up level? Or is it this strategic, overarching, visionary change? You know, what is your perspective? What did you find related to like, which one of those works better? Is it completely situational? You know, what did your research tell us here?
First thing that popped out over and over again was, no matter what direction you start from, because that's kind of what you were implying, you have to start with the idea of truth, talent, and timing. That's actually one of our secret sauce ingredients that comes from the book. That concept, written by a gentleman by the name of Ron Sugar, who wrote the foreword for the book. He was my CDO when I was the chief HR officer for Northrop Grumman, so very experienced guy in a variety of different big change in organizations. The truth part we've already talked about, which is the importance of, you know, facts and understanding and accepting data and reality. Second piece, talent, basically means surrounding yourself with people who are really going to help you make the change happen. And that's irrespective of which direction you start from. And then the last one I think is probably the most important because it's the one people struggle with, and that is timing. What I mean by that, or what he meant by that, was generally you're going to need to go faster than typically feels comfortable. You know, speed and pace actually matters a lot, and it also matters a lot more than which direction you start with. The other thing that I think speaks directly to the question you were asking, Kyle, is this idea of generally leaders of transformational change have to go first, but not alone. So they need to set the tone, they need to set the example, they need to provide some sense of urgency, some clarity as to why the change is necessary. They have to be a good role model. One of the fun inputs we got for the book, somebody who really said it very simply but very wisely, was transform yourself before trying to change others. And that really does set the tone. But almost never is there an example of a highly successful transformational change effort that was led by one person at the top. You know, they might set the tone. It's important that they be a supporter and an advocate and a good role model, but they're never going to do it on their own. And successful leaders of change travel in packs, so they're not doing it on their own. But leadership comes from many levels. You know, I think one of the other big themes in the book, just to close out my response to this particular question, is that leadership turns out to be a lot more important than leaders. And what I mean by that is that, you know, irrespective of what the org chart says or whether somebody told you that your title is being a leader, having leaders actively involved in leading change, you know, of course, makes a lot of sense and is necessary, but it isn't nearly as important and valuable as having people be leaders of change at every level of the organization, no matter what their job title is, no matter what their responsibilities are. They can make a huge, huge difference in the execution of change, either because they're helping to lead it or they're spending a lot of their energy trying to resist and undermine it. And there's plenty of that going on in organizations, as I'm sure you and your listeners are all very well aware of. So I find one of the biggest mistakes that leaders in general and HR people also make about leading change, to tie a bow on this question about, you know, what direction do you start from, is, you know, they look at an org chart and they try to cascade down from the top to the bottom all of the information and the tools and the energy and the impetus for change. And it's very hierarchical, but most organizations don't really work in a hierarchy. They work through a network of people who have relationships and trust each other or don't trust each other, collaborate, don't collaborate. So figuring out who the right influencers are in the organization who can help not only explain, but, you know, role model and support the need for change. And also at the same time, figuring out who the likely resistors are to the change, and equally loving and respecting both the influencers and the resistors, is actually much more important and effective than looking at an org chart and starting with the CEO and the leadership team and cascading to the next level of vice presidents and cascading to the next level below them as the directors and the managers and all the rest. So one of the pieces of advice we offer in the book is ignore the org chart, because that's usually not the right methodology by which you're going to lead or introduce or sustain successful transformation or change.
It's fascinating. You know, it's a little bit counterintuitive. You know, so often you think, well, the only way we're going to get this change work through is making sure we have the support from the top, right? But yeah, you know, I'm chuckling here when you said the resistors, and I'm sure many of our listeners at that point had a number of different faces pop into their head at that point, the people that they know are the resistors to change. But yeah, you cannot overestimate or underestimate the importance of some of those like informal leaders, right? The people that you know, they're either going to be on board or they're not. And that's a key determinant. So yeah, I've lived that. That makes perfect sense. I'm curious, you know, to go back to this timing question, because I do think it's critical. And I think all of us at this point in this day and age are really feeling the need to go faster. And things seems like they're changing at a much more frequent rate. And but that can be really, really hard to kind of balance the, you know, that need to go faster, but also make sure that you're bringing the team along for the ride, and like that people aren't so uncomfortable that they get destabilized. Where did you find any tactics or tendencies, or was there any kind of focus on that aspect as you were writing this book?
Yes, very much so. And, you know, at the top level, it usually gets translated into, you know, communicate, you know, where you're trying, generally speaking, to, you know, educate people about the need for change and what are some of the steps we're planning on taking, and how do we know when we are successful? And that's all real important. However, what I have found over and over again, as we were doing the book, was the first instinct that people have when you talk about communication is tell. You know, I'm going to tell you as the leader, you know, why all of these things need to happen and their level of importance. And I'm also going to tell you about the role that you need to play. That information is valuable. But if you want to get to the point that you are dealing with, which is the balance between speed and some of the uncertainty that comes from going too fast, or maybe more importantly, the discomfort, you actually have to listen. You know, you have to spend a lot of time listening to people. What's working? What isn't working? What's getting in your way? What's causing you problems? What resources do you need in order to be more effective dealing with customers or clients? You know, how do we help change the organization for the better? And, you know, what is getting in your way personally? As an individual trying to get your job done to the best of your ability, that's a lot of listening. And so, yeah, change takes time. There's no doubt about it. You have to work your way through the organization and make sure that you're in touch with people who work with it for you. But I think a lot of leaders make the mistake of, you know, 80% tell and 20% listen, when in fact the formula should be exactly reversed. And the situations where, you know, we did a lot of, you know, storytelling or story listening in the book to successful leaders who have led transformational change, one of the most consistent factors over and over again was they spent a lot of time with their people listening to what was working well and not working well. And that helped to raise up the awareness about the need for large scale transformation change, rather than having just the CEO or the senior leadership team declare, you know, we're terrible, therefore we need to change. But nobody else understands where that came from or why. That's usually not very effective.
Yeah, great call out. And, you know, take it from a guy that has a podcast that, you know, likes to talk a lot. You know, that listening can be a challenge sometimes, but, you know, the communication is two ways, right? So there's got to be a balance. We've already kind of touched on this, the secret sauce for pizza. We've talked about pizza ingredients. And we've talked about a couple other aspects of the secret sauce. And I know there's 10 ingredients in the book. So I just want to ask you, which one of those ingredients do you want our listeners to kind of walk away with thinking about? And then, of course, they have to pick up the book to read about the others.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm going to go back actually to something that we were touching on a few minutes ago, because it's so important and seems to be very counterintuitive for people, which is the idea of love influencers and resistors. Because I think most of us, particularly as HR people, we oftentimes get put in the position of figuring out who the influencers are, usually in the context of the people who are big supporters who we can turn to for help, and who we know are going to be loyal to us and to the organization in helping to drive change. Those people are very much needed. We also have a tendency, though, as HR people in particular, to be dismissive of or not very friendly to the people we identify as resistors. You know, the natural tendency is to ignore what they have to say, run over them, work around them, or get rid of them. Now, sometimes you have to do one or more of those things, but not before you spend enough time understanding what they're resisting and why they're resisting it, because they may actually be asking tough questions that nobody else is willing to ask that would, in fact, if answered and addressed, make the whole transformational change effort better and more effective, which is why, you know, I use the terminology love influencers and resistors, because both kinds of people can make enormous contributions to your transformational change effort if you're willing to respect what they have to say, even if you disagree with it, listen to their concerns and pushback, and treat them more as skeptics, you know, who are trying to ensure that the organization is doing the right things, rather than as negative people who simply don't want to come along for the ride. Sometimes they don't, and you need to deal with those people eventually. But most resistors, I think, are more skeptical and simply want to make sure that we're not doing the wrong thing for the wrong reasons before they get on board. Those people can be extraordinarily valuable and helpful.
You know, it's funny, and I do think it's counterintuitive. And, you know, I distinctly remember early in my career, this is going to sound terrible now, even in retrospect, thinking about this language, it's just kind of terrible. But the term that was used was, well, they're not a company man, you know, and the longer I was in my career, the more I realized that's really just a euphemism for they don't agree with me. Right. And oh, by the way, it's not a very inclusive term either, but I think, you know, really problematic, to be thinking in those terms when, you know, those resistors are going to be the first ones that say, I told you so, if it doesn't go right.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's absolutely right. And they're also particularly good, I find, at ferreting out one of the other distinctions that came out over and over in the book that turned out to be really important, which is there's a big difference between doing things differently and driving improvement. You know, just because it's different doesn't mean it's better. Mm. And unless you're clear about, you know, what you're trying to change and why you're trying to change it, you can easily get lulled into a false sense of security in believing, particularly if you're a new leader, where you're coming in from outside the organization. It's the old, you know, new sheriff in town kind of syndrome, where I'm going to show everybody that I'm new, I'm in charge, and I'm going to make a bunch of changes. But, you know, simply doing things differently just to show that you're in charge doesn't necessarily drive improvement. And there's evidence of that, you know, not only all over this book, but all over life. Where things have been, you know, dramatically changed, but it didn't get better. It actually got worse. And so I think one of the more important aspects that, you know, HR people who are, you know, listening to this podcast can do is to make sure that the right questions are being asked and the right measures and metrics are in place to determine, you know, what is it we're actually trying to change. I call it in the book, from what to what, so that there's clarity about where we're coming from, what got us here. Some of those things were very successful. How do we preserve those successful things without throwing, you know, out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak, before we skip past all of that and start talking about the future and what we want to change and do, hopefully, not only differently, but better. We also have to make sure we understand where we came from so that we don't screw up what we were doing successfully on the way here. I think HR people can, you know, frame those questions properly and are willing to push back and ask some hard questions. They might come across as resistors at first, but they're actually adding a lot of value to making sure the organization doesn't drive off a cliff at 100 miles an hour.
Couldn't agree more. And I, you know, I can guarantee you that if you ask a tough question in a, you know, in a meeting, and it's the right question, and it prevents a really big mistake, that senior leader is going to appreciate that a whole lot more than if you're just a yes person.
Yeah. And I mean, it adds tremendous value.
Yeah.
By the way, not always in the meeting, in the moment, does the senior leader act like they appreciate it? It's yeah. usually only later that they realize that you prevented us from making a disastrous mistake, and now I value it and I appreciate it. You have to be okay, nonetheless, with not getting the immediate love and positive feedback from that leader in the moment, because they may be more focused on how do I get this done quickly, not whether it's the right thing to get done in the first place. That's our job, is to help, you know, minimize the risk of those kinds of big and bad decisions being made.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this has just been a wonderful conversation, and I really appreciate you putting the time in to put this book together. I think a really important topic and something that many of us struggle with, both personally and professionally. So appreciate you putting this down. We're going to shift gears, and I'm fascinated to hear your perspective on the Rebel HR Flash Round. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
All right. Question number one, where does HR need to rebel?
I think the place we need to rebel the most is in following traditional practices that used to work with the workforce and the workplace of the past. The most specific example of that that I'll offer, just to be concrete right now, is the debate everybody's going through around remote work, hybrid work, bringing everybody back to the quote-unquote office, and recognizing that while it might be the preference of leaders who've been around for 50 years, that everybody's, you know, working in the building eyeball to eyeball at the same time, that's not really where the workforce is going. So helping organizations figure that out, I think, is extremely important. And that's it's a great way for us to rebel, but also do it in a constructive way.
Absolutely. Here's a great example. So on that exact topic, I was having a conversation with another HR professional the other day, and they were talking about, you know, this perception that people aren't working as hard, right? And this HR person didn't necessarily share that perception. Their leader was making comments like, well, no, there's no cars in the parking lot past 4 o'clock, you know, or people aren't coming into the offices early. I just think people are being lazy. And, you know, we need to make sure they get back in the office so we can make sure they're not being lazy. So my question to that person was, well, have we actually pulled like the utilization numbers off of the computers that they use to do their job? And, you know, sure enough, you go and you dig through and you're like, oh, wow, people are working a lot more than they would if we were having them in a, you know, an 8 to 5 with a 1 hour lunch in the office. They're just not doing that work in the hours that we tell them that we want them in the office. Right. So it's like, got to shift mindset a little bit there.
So
right?
It's a great example, and unfortunately all too common, because a lot of people ask me the question, what do you think is the biggest obstacle to organizations moving more aggressively towards some version of hybrid or more flexible work? And my answer is depressing, but very simple, which is trust. I think the thing that causes, you know, most leaders to be concerned about whether people are working remotely is, if I don't see you, how do I know you're working? And this example that you just gave is the perfect illustration of that.
Yeah. The honest answer should be, you're getting all your work done.
That's right.
Right? I mean, isn't that really all we want? We just want people to get all their work. But I, you know, my hypothesis is that we have a lot of managers that have always relied on managing by just being around somebody, as opposed to actually managing by objective and like, and goals, and, you know, actually setting clear and, you know, important timelines for people to consider themselves successful in their role. That's a lot harder than managing by walking around, right?
Success is delivering results. Success is not process. You know, sometimes you have to have good process to deliver good results, but not always. And sometimes the results actually speak for themselves.
That's the next book, isn't it? So we won't.
No, my next book will be a book about writing a book, because it's a whole experience.
Well, when you have like 35 different collaborators that, you know, that makes the challenge, I can't imagine.
Yeah, great cat herding exercise.
Yeah. All right. We are way off the rails on the Rebel HR Flash Round. So question number two, who should we be listening to?
This is not a specific person. It's a category of people, and that would be customers or clients. I think one of the things that HR people, as much as I love the profession and the people that I work with, fall short on is that we're too internally focused. You know, we're spending a lot of our time dealing with internal issues and problems and people, and all that has to get addressed. But It's much easier to figure out what our priorities are from a people standpoint if we understand what clients or customers external to our organization actually think about us as an organization and what we're like to deal with. That will teach you a tremendous amount about what really matters in winning in the marketplace and executing your strategy, is to understand client and customer input. A lot of HR people haven't really been brought up that way, but that's a shift that we need to make.
I could not agree more. And, you know, I think this actually gets at one of the deeper issues that we find, especially in HR and other admin functions. It's not just limited to HR, but you get so focused on your process. You know, you consider your customers internal, you know, you're a back office function or whatever you want to call it. But, you know, at the end of the day, the customers matter. You know, they are really, really critical to understand. And those are the individuals or companies or what have you that the people that you are supporting are supporting. And so you need to have a good understanding of what their needs are. And ultimately, I think that's, you know, this whole question about how do I get a seat at the table? How do I elevate the profession? If you understand the customers, you understand the business better. If you understand the business better, you're going to have better insight. If you have better insight, people are going to ask you to be at the table, to give your perspective, right? And to drive transformational change, for instance. So I couldn't agree more. I think it's a really important thing. I actually think, you know, believe it or not, that might be the first time anybody's answered that question in 120 episodes with actual external customers. So there you go.
I'll be waiting for my prize to arrive in the mail. Thank you.
That's two merit badges. If we're keeping track, that's two merit badges for you. All right. Last question. How can our listeners connect with you?
Maybe the simplest way, one-stop shop, would be the website that we've set up for our book, which is www.transformationalchangebook.com, where people can go to get information not only on me, but other contributing authors, the summaries for each of the chapters, so they have a better idea of what's in the book. There's also an ability to order the book directly at a discount. So that'll probably be the simplest place for people to go and find me and more information about the book as well.
Awesome. We will have that in the show notes as always. Feel free to open up your podcast player, click in, check it out. Definitely appreciate the time here, Ian. I know you're super busy and appreciate you sharing your expertise and from one tenured HR professional to another, really appreciate the time in the profession and helping us all get a little bit better.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Kyle. Great to be with you today.
Thanks, Ian. All right, that does it for the Rebel HR podcast. Big thank you to our guests. Follow us on Facebook at Rebel HR Podcast, Twitter at Rebel HR Guy, or see our website at rebelhumanresources.com. The views and opinions expressed by Rebel HR Podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of any of the organizations that we represent. No animals were harmed during the filming of this podcast. Baby.